This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.
This podcast is a production of kcrw.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business. This week on The Business, horror films are once again scaring up terrifying box office profits. We'll check in with the director of the wildly successful Hostel movies, then cut to the producer of the Saw movies. Your skin will crawl, your ears will bleed. It's The Business from NPR. We start with a cautionary tale from Silicon Valley. Eye-popping email, purported to be an internal Apple computer communication, was forwarded last week to AOL's tech blog, Engadget. The missive claimed that Apple was delaying the launch of the highly anticipated iPhone from June until October. As a result, Apple lost $4 billion in market cap, as its stock dropped over 2% that morning. The punchline? The email was a fake. It must be particularly painful for a company that worships technology to be burned so badly by it. But not as painful as it's going to be for the guy who forwarded that email. Elsewhere, the U.S. Treasury Department investigation of documentarian Michael Moore is heating up, and the Weinstein Company is capitalizing on the controversy. Working on his healthcare expose, Sicko, Moore went to Cuba with September 11th workers to get free healthcare after they manifested symptoms from the cleanup of Ground Zero. However, the trip was a violation of the U.S. ban on travel to Fidel's little island getaway. Girding their loins to battle the Bushies, Chris Lehane, a political consultant on the film, said in an interview with The Hollywood Reporter that the Weinsteins would, quote, go to the mattress for this film, unquote. Chris, we think, in fact, we pray that you mean go to the mat. Speaking of having sex for money, porn.com, one of the most lusted-after domain names on the web, was sold for $9 million last week. That makes it the second most expensive internet domain ever sold, after sex.com, which sold for an estimated $12 million in 2004. Sadly, though, efforts to sell masturbation.com have proven fruitless, owing to rampant fears that any buyer would soon go blind. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Later in the show, tips for your trip to the Cannes Film Festival. But next, scaring audiences all the way to the bank. Whether as a reaction to an increasingly dangerous world, the need to look death in the face, or just an excuse to grab someone's hand, horror films of one type or another have been around since the beginning of film. They've often been low rent and low budget, which is funny because it was European auteurs, having lived through the real horror of World War I, who first brought them to the screen. It was Lon Chaney in 1923 as The Hunchback of Notre Dame that made horror an American staple and made The Man of a Thousand Faces America's first horror movie star. At $2,500 a week for Hunchback, it was clear that even back then, Hollywood saw the horror genre as a worthwhile investment. Through the 40s, Universal Pictures was the horror studio, serving up a monstrous good time with Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman, and the Mummy.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
The nuclear-fueled frenzy of 1950s America saw an explosion, pun intended, of the horror genre with a science fiction bent. Small studios like American International and the recently revived Hammer Films took over the genre, hiring horror masters like Roger Corman to direct low-budget mutants and giant insects in their attacks. But most of the time, it was aliens, Martians, and planet men that were always invading, invading, invading.
Fire!
The films left the dark and gothic otherworld and moved into our world, though it was a world that seemed to be made out of aluminum foil and cardboard. The characters seemed to be made out of cardboard, too.
We are ready to report, Excellency.
You are many days late.
It was unavoidable.
The Japanese, of course, also sent over their version of monster films. In the 1960s, the Armageddon film appeared. George Romero gave birth to the zombie movie, and Hitchcock popularized the psychological thriller horror hybrid. In 1964, the Hays Morals Code was repealed, freeing the makers of horror films to make them, well, more horrific. Up sprang B-movie cult films like 2000 Maniacs that spent most of their tiny budgets on buckets of blood. The 70s saw the rise of great independent film and the birth of horror films like Rosemary's Baby that were also just great films.
What have you done to it? What have you done to its eyes?
He has his father's eyes.
There was Carrie, there was The Exorcist, and there was The Shining.
Here's Johnny!
That quip by Jack Nicholson added a certain knowing wink to horror, fueling the horror slasher film renaissance that would follow for the next decade.
Please, God.
This is God.
Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, Friday the 13th, their sequels, their ripoffs, would make a giant amount of money, but they'd also bankrupt the genre creatively and kind of burn it out. Then came Scream in 1996, which would play homage to the genre, poke fun of it, and provide a few real scares. It would kick off perhaps the most profitable resurgence of the slasher film since the days of Jason Voorhees.
Hello?
Hello.
Who is this?
Tell me your name, I'll tell you mine.
I don't think so.
What's that noise?
Popcorn.
You making popcorn?
Well, I'm getting ready to watch a video.
Really? Why?
Well, just some scary movie.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
You never told me your name.
Why do you want to know my name?
Because I want to know who I'm looking at.
Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Grudge, The Ring, Hostel, Saw, they all went on to make coffin loads of money. But Hostel and Saw were special. They were so incredibly cheap to make and so inexpensively and cleverly marketed, they were hugely profitable. Audiences loved these movies. So much so, they've spawned successful sequels and inspired many less successful imitators. They were also so disturbing that at the last Sundance Film Festival, the MPAA's ratings chief, Joan Graves, expressed special concern about them, mentioning them by name. So who better to talk about the new horror phenomenon of what's being called torture porn than Eli Roth, the director and writer of the Hostel movies, and Oren Koolis, the producer of the Saw horror mega franchise. Eli Roth, Oren Koolis, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Very excited to be doing this.
Nice to be here.
I want to ask you guys about the budgets of these movies. It's really stunning when you look at the return on investment, just from a business standpoint, how well you guys seem to have done for yourselves with some of these movies and how badly the studios seem to do when they try their hand at it. By example, at least according to boxofficemojo.com, which professes to have some accuracy when it comes to these matters, the first Saw movie, released in 2004, was made for $1.2 million. Worldwide gross was $103 million. Saw 2, made for $4 million. Worldwide gross, $147 million. Saw 3, made for $10 million. You're getting profligate here, Oren. And worldwide gross of $164 million. By comparison, you look at a movie like Disturbia, which is a movie that just was released by, I think it was DreamWorks. It was made for $20 million and so far is only doing about how much, guys? About
40 to 50?
Yeah.
Low budget. Disturbia is actually a home run compared to... You could use 30 or 40 examples of studio movies that cost, you know, 20 to 30 or 40 is trying to capture the horror genre and do 10. Generally what studios do is they just take a movie and they basically bombard people with TV, with radio, with billboards, and there are six or eight really important horror sites. And I know, especially directors like Eli, have really catered to those sites. We give them special blogs. We give them information. We let them release posters. And
What are some of those sites?
Well, yeah, Bloody Disgusting is one.
You know,
uh-huh. Ain't It Cool News is another. I mean, Dread Central.
People don't understand, well, how did I, you know, I didn't see it 10,000 times on TV. Well, because, you know what, playing it on a friend's rerun doesn't help anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, what you'll find is that a studio, for example, will spend millions of dollars advertising on a show like Lost or Heroes. You know, that's where they'll blast their movie. What we'll do is we'll put banner ads and flash animation ads on the horror sites, which are the same eyeballs. The same people that are watching the really expensive television shows to advertise are also looking at internet sites like IGN and stuff that, you know, a lot of people might not know about, but that our fans know about.
Why are... I guess what we will call ultra horror movies. You know, films like, well, Eli, you've got a movie coming out hopefully soon where women are bathing in blood. Why are movies like this such good business right now? Why are they doing so well?
You know, we always knew that the scare is the star, and that put your money into the scare, and that you don't need, you know, these guys are great producers, and they understand how to spend money effectively. And they know that nobody wants to see a $50 million version of Saw 2. People love Saw movies specifically because they have that gritty rawness, and it's the filmmaking that make the films so effective. You know, people aren't paying to see big special effects. They're paying to be scared.
Maybe, but if you look at the, you know, if you look at the amount of, even just, you know, you count exteriors versus interiors. I mean, you know, look at Eli's movies and our movies. We just try to use our head. We try to put our money into the things that are, you know, try to get the most bang for our buck. We're not sitting for a year in post in CGI houses.
Yeah,
I mean, we do. I mean,
we're both filming in factories and warehouses and practical locations.
Mm-hmm. There's a quote here that is attributed to you from an interview done on MTV.com.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote is, "When I go to see an R-rated horror movie, I want lots of violence. I want nudity. I want sex and violence mixed together. What's wrong with that?" That's a quote from you, Eli.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about that. Does that, in a sense, both amp up the appeal of these movies in that there is a sexual dimension to them, and does it make your job, Oren, as a producer, does it make it harder for you to cut the movie to an acceptable rating through the MPAA? And I'll go to Eli first to get his take on that.
Sure. Well, I would say that, you know, I think our films are first and foremost scary, and we're not making sexual movies per se, but we just don't want to have, if you have a scene where there's nudity in it, to have the girl covering up the clothes to her neck or the guy covering up, you know, we want, you know, what I think part of the appeal of the hostel films, you know, certainly for the Saw, is the rawness of them and the feel that these are the dangerous movies. These are the films that live in that danger zone where you're going to see things that are going to scare you more than any other. These are the bad, you know, the bad boys. They're the ones that are going to scare you more than the other films. And I don't like, you know, I'm not saying I want sex and violence in real life, but when I see a horror movie that is R-rated, that's what I want to see in a movie. You know, I think the ratings board, what they get upset about specifically is sexual violence, so you have to be very careful in how you shoot it and how you handle it, and it's actually a lot of back and forth with the MPAA, and what's great is that I've had a very good open discussion with them about everything, and they know me, and they know what my fans want and what they're there to see, so you know, I've been able to get my films rated with an R rating fairly unscathed. And in my experience working with the MPAA, I found it to be extremely reasonable.
Let me ask you about that. When you were cutting your latest movie and submitting it for an MPAA rating, there was a scene where someone is bathing in blood, and there's a distinction to be made there. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
Particular.
There's, without giving too much of the movie, there's a character bathing in blood, and they said, okay, this is a horror movie, we get it, people are paying for the scares, this is a big scene. But when the character was touching her breast, that was what sort of sexualized the violence, that they felt was pushing it into NC-17 territory. And they said, we get that it's violence, but when it's very specifically sexual violence, that's not okay, and that's where we're going into this NC-17 territory. And so I edited the scene, so I took out really the sexual element of it, and the scene is still very effective and very scary. You know, and really what they're doing is it's not a censorship board. They're reflecting what the parents of America are going to say.
Mm-hmm.
and how parents, because it's a board made up of parents. So that's kind of what you have to, you know, it's really like you just look at the culture. If we have violence on television, people watch it no problem. On 24, the stuff that I did in Hostel 1 is now on 24. Janet Jackson shows her nipple and Congress is in session meeting about it, and there's all sorts of fines. So they really, I think, are just reflecting the temperature of the culture.
Oren Kulis, let me ask you about that. As a producer of these films, you've got to be the sort of liaison between the guy yelling action and the guys who are just yelling at the studio.
What is
sex sells, violence sells, sex and violence sells even more. Is it harder, even as you get an expanded audience from sex and violence, is it harder to get the movie approved and marketed?
I think it's the opposite. I think that, you know, I think that the success of these movies, especially with certain, you know, with the filmmakers, I think if a first-time filmmaker might have come in and tried to do something that Eli or us do, they might not get the same treatment only because we've been very respectful of the process. We've been very collaboratively with the studios in the process. I mean, in the MPAA, and we don't try to bully them. We don't try to overrun them. but they also know that we kind of know the market, and we don't try. You know, it's not a fight. It's not a war. It's okay. It's a little bit of a trade off here. It's a little bit of a trade off there. And it's also, you know, being respectful of them.
I want to ask you, Eli. As long as you're mentioning that, you were saying, I think in your films for Hostel, what was the audience demographic like? Could you share with us that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it was split up, and there were a lot of teenage girls, but we had a strong Latino presence. There was a very strong Spanish audience for us. There was a lot of the urban audience definitely came out to support it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it wasn't just like a bunch of geeky guys. The screenings that I went to, it was lots and lots and lots of teenage girls.
Wherever
the teenage girls go, that's where the teenage guys are going to go.
That's where boys are, exactly.
So where do you get those sort of mascara-clad eyeballs? How do you seduce them into seeing a movie that might be counterintuitive for them to go see?
Well, this is Oren. Why would you think it would be counterintuitive?
Well, traditionally, the audience, and you can disabuse me of this if I've got it wrong, but the traditional core audience of horror movies was predominantly urban, and if it sounds to me Eli's saying is that a lot of young teenage girls, whether they be white, black, or orange, are going to see this movie. I'm interested.
I think they always went, and we just didn't realize it. I really do, because you know, we talked to girls in their 30s, or you know, even girls in their 40s. You know, all saw The Exorcist, all saw the Friday series, all saw Halloween. I mean, they all were. They'll talk about where they were the first time they saw Friday the 13th,
mm-hmm.
and these aren't just free. These are just normal, everyday girls. So I think it's an audience that was just never really expected to go. And once people started really doing counting and exit polls based on gender and race and age, that people realized that it was a 50-50 demographic.
It was something that we, as you know, the creators of these films, we always knew, but that the statisticians hadn't really recorded yet. Exactly what what Oren's saying. But I think that really the audience that goes to see horror movies are the people that are on a date. And it's teenagers on dates. And guys know that if they take a girl to go see a horror movie, that their chances are pretty good that they're going to hold that girl's hand. And girls know if they're going to take a guy to see a horror movie, it's a good excuse to squeeze that guy's arm.
But there's horror and there's horror. I mean, you guys are taking this in a particularly splattery kind of area. Are you guys worried at all that there is a point of diminishing returns, or there's a point at which you can go too far and turn off that date audience?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I mean, the way to turn them off is to make a stupid movie. If you make a movie that's really gratuitously violent, if you make a film, if it's Black Christmas or See No Evil, that's a really stupid movie, and there's a couple gory moments in it, people aren't going to see it. What people love and what I love about the Saw movies is that they're smart, and the traps are clever, and they have the great twists, and the dialogue is fun, and you love the characters. You get so into those movies, and the people that are making them are smart. And that's what, I try to put in all my films, is a level of intelligence that people really kind of underestimate the horror films, because for so many years they were made sort of without care, and they just thought, oh, let's just get a bunch of teenagers, and let's get some new weapons in, and let's just kill them in different ways. But we said, no, let's have real characters and real actors and real stories and real performance, and let's make a great movie. Yeah, it's a horror movie, but let's make, first and foremost, we're going to make a movie that we're proud of, that we consider is a really good movie. You know, it's hard for me to get scared in movies, and that's why I'm so thankful that these guys are making their movies, because basically it's up to Darren and James and Rob Zombie. There are only a handful of people that can still scare me. So I'm just as excited as everyone else to go see the next one.
But we take our time. I mean, we actually work on our scripts. This isn't just like how much blood can we pour. I mean, we spend so many hours working on traps and sitting down with the production designers and saying, how can we do this differently? How can we make this look like an engineer made this, out of raw tools in his warehouse? You know, we don't try to out-gadget. We try to make it rawer and cooler. I mean, when you look at, even from Saw 1, it was a guy in a room with razor wire. He gets out, he lives. It's really simple.
Coming up after a short break, more with horror writer and director Eli Roth and producer Oren Koulas. They're making more dollars per scream than anyone else in film today. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The indies have been leading a huge horror comeback in the last couple of years with clever, low-budget, cheaply marketed, ultra-violent films with no stars to speak of. The result has been exceptionally lucrative. Meanwhile, the studios, with their delicate sensibilities, big marketing budgets, and name-brand actors, haven't done so well. Sony's $19 million slasher film, Vacancy, for instance, opened to an $8 million weekend. Compare that to Saw 2, which cost just a quarter of what Vacancy cost and opened with four times the gross. Hostel cost $4.8 million, and it made $20 million in its first weekend. Both the Saw and Hostel films were distributed by the indie studio Lionsgate. Eli Roth is the writer and director of the Hostel movies, and Oren Koolis produced the Saw franchise. I want to ask you, why are you at a company like Lionsgate? Is there anything special about them?
You know, at the studios, they get caught up in playing everything safe, that nobody wants to take any risks and take any chances, and they want to do everything exactly the same. At Lionsgate, it's really, you know, one of the only companies where they're not afraid to push the boundaries, and they're putting blood in the Saw posters and doing blood drives on Howard Stern and sponsoring UFC fights. Just their whole mentality, because they're an independent company, is that they think outside the box. The other thing is the cost of the movies. If you're dealing with a studio, a movie that costs $15 or $20 million, that is the cheapest movie they're going to make. They're making movies that cost $200 million.
The studio average last year, and it'll be up this year. The studio average last year, I think, was $76.5 million. Is what I read. So I mean,
average.
Yeah, average movie. The average movie was $76 million. Lionsgate. You walk into a Best Buy the week Saw comes out, or the week Hostel comes out. I mean, you're bombarded. You have to walk around walls of Saw movies or wall around Hostel movies just to get to the video department in Best Buy or Target or any of the big retailers.
So it has the power of the distribution of a major studio, but it has the intimacy of a small independent company.
Let's talk about who's watching these movies, and in particular, I'm curious. Besides Americans, where's in the world is horror doing well?
I've seen, you know, the UK, they're very big. Italy, Germany,
Spain. I mean, all of them.
Spain.
Japan, I mean,
huge.
Yeah, I mean,
France. They're going crazy.
But I think also horror travels. I mean, I think you don't need, you know, how do you tell a joke in a different language? You don't need dialogue to scare somebody.
Yeah, it's great to watch, you know, the scary scenes play if you're in Prague, if you're in Brazil, if you're in France. I've watched my film play with audiences all around the world, and the scary scenes, everyone's always screaming and covering their eyes. Horror is universal.
Let's talk a little bit about some recent controversies that have happened and how they might affect the kind of movies that you make. I'm thinking of After Dark Pictures' release of Captivity, which is a Roland Joffé movie that had a very controversial outdoor campaign, one that they claim that, you know, in fairness to Courtney Solomon, who runs After Dark Pictures, we did try and call him. Nobody picking up the phone there. But there was a very visceral campaign which showed Felicia Cuthbert sort of splattered all over a billboard, both first captured, then tortured. And the result of that was that the Motion Picture Association of America brought the hammer down very hard on that movie, and basically it cost them their release date because they would not issue a rating for several months as the punishment. I'd like to talk a little bit about that. As movies seek to push the envelope on advertising, does that affect you? Does it concern you at all? Do you have to consider your campaigns? I would imagine everyone who makes horror movies watched that sort of debacle very closely.
You know, we had two posters banned, and you know, it was kind of fun. We put something out there that was, you know, pretty controversial. We pulled it, and you know, it was a great item for eBay. You know, and it got us some press.
And it gets you some free ink and street cred, I would think.
Yeah, but we certainly weren't ever going to jeopardize a release date, or certainly not going to go piss off the gods.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's good controversy and there's bad controversy.
Yeah, exactly.
There's the kind of controversy where the movie comes out and go, oh my God, this movie's so violent, you know, in the way that The Exorcist caused controversy.
Mm-hmm.
There's bad controversy when you have someone like Courtney Solomon who blatantly puts up ridiculously violent billboards all over town without the approval of the MPAA. Now, any way you want to cut, I don't care what excuse you make, I saw those billboards and I was shocked. And I said, how could that get up there? And the truth of the matter is, he spent his own money putting them up without asking permission.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes it difficult for everyone. So it's no surprise that the MPAA brought the hammer down, because what we're talking about is, you know, when the Saw movies, when the Hostel movies, when our posters go up, we present everything to the MPA. We say, this is what the poster we'd like to do, and if they have suggestions, we make changes. Everything we do has their blessing on it. They have approved it. This guy just basically said, I'm not going to listen to you guys. I'm going to do what I want. And he put something up, and it pissed people off.
Does it make your job harder as a director?
Oh, absolutely, because I wind up being responsible for it. Everyone's like, wow, look at this torture fat. I saw the words bind, you know, capture, bind, torture. The only word I saw was rip-off, rip-off, rip-off. Those are the only words that came through to me. And I thought, you know what, if I had kids and I was doing, I don't want that up in my neighborhood. What I think is so beautiful about the Saw posters and, you know, and the Hostel posters is that, as Quentin Tarantino put it when he saw one of the posters, he's like, this is like an exploitation poster by way of Diane Arbus. Like, there's an artistry to them. They're actually, they're creepy and scary, but they're beautiful photographs, and they're very well done, smart campaigns. The Captivity one was just gratuitous, and it was blown up, you know, in front of everybody's face.
And business-wise, it blew up in their face, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, look at that. I mean, listen, in the bottom line is Eli's an artist and a very good artist, but, I mean, we still listen to Lionsgate. I mean, we listen to them. I know in the Saw films, and I know Eli's unbelievably close to them. We're following them. I mean, we're listening to them. We're not going to go challenge the MPAA because we think we're right.
We got to leave it there. Eli Roth is the writer, director, and producer of Hostel and its sequel, Hostel 2. And Oren Koolis is the producer of the Saw franchise of movies. Saw 4 comes out, Oren, August?
October 26th.
26th. See it with someone whose hand you want to squeeze. Coming up next, a horror of a different kind, the Cannes Film Festival. The Cannes Film Festival began last week. For first-timers headed to the south of France for the glamour, the glitz, the champagne, the parties, we have these rules from Cannes veteran and indie producer extraordinaire Christine Vachon.
Cannes Film Festival, rule number one. Keep watching the ground, as France does not seem to have any pooper-scooper laws. Rule number two. Keep watching the ground, as France has an inordinate number of small dogs on leashes. Cannes rule number three. Do not expect to have great food just because you are in the south of France. Every big lunch in Cannes is a buffet, and the main ingredient is mayonnaise. Shrimp, cucumber, crab, pasta, all warming in the sun. Cannes rule number four. People will sometimes get up and leave in the middle of a movie or a meeting. Get used to it. Cannes was founded on principled rejection. Cannes rule number five. 5 hours of sleep is a lot of sleep. Cannes rule number six. There is always some other great thing happening that you have not been invited to. Cannes rule number seven. Even if it is only for a few hours, don't forget that you are in the south of France. Eight, maybe the most important. In a market like this one, you can't really accuse anyone else of being a prostitute. Cannes rule number nine, never pay for anything. In a town where an ice cream cone can run $10, you can save your child's college tuition by having distributors and foreign sales companies pick up your dinner or drinks tab. Cannes rule number 10, you will look like shit by the end. Embrace it.
Good, practical advice from Christine Vachon from her book, A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.